From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Radio Martí les habla Eduardo Luján y me acompañan en el estudio.
Juana Isa.
Should state-run media be broadcast in the United States? The Bush administration recently reached deals with two South Florida commercial stations to broadcast radio and TV Martí, which are run by the U.S. government. We'll host a debate. But first, police entrapment. A Pakistani immigrant was sentenced to 30 years in prison for plotting to bomb the Herald Square Macy's subway station in New York. His lawyer says he was set up by a police informant.
It's unfortunate that the New York City Police Department created a crime in order to solve it and claim a victory in the war on terror.
Defense attorney Martin Stoller will join us in our firehouse studio. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The U.S. military engaged in some of its most intense fighting of the Iraq War in Baghdad Tuesday on the eve of President Bush's expected announcement to send some 20,000 more troops to Iraq. American helicopters and fighter jets circled the neighborhood around Haifa Street as more than 1,000 U.S. and Iraqi soldiers battled insurgents. Iraqi officials say at least 50 insurgents were killed. On Capitol Hill, Democratic Senator Edward Kennedy said he'd introduce legislation requiring congressional support for any further escalation of the Iraq War.
Our bill will say that no additional troops can be sent and no additional dollars can be spent on such an escalation unless and until Congress approves the president's plan. We cannot simply speak out against an escalation of troops in Iraq. We must act to prevent it.
Democratic leaders have not endorsed Kennedy's proposal and instead say they'll introduce non-binding resolutions on President Bush's as early as next week. At the White House, Press Secretary Tony Snow urged Democrats to back the president.
Democrats are going to have to make a choice here, and they're going to have to decide where they stand in terms of two issues. Number one, do you want Iraq to succeed? And if so, what does that mean? And number two, do you believe in supporting the troops, as you say, and how do you express that support?
The first wave of new U.S. troops expected before the end of the month. Most will go to Baghdad, followed by Anbar province. The prospect of an expanded military occupation is meeting fears in Baghdad. Resident Abu Haider spoke on Tuesday.
All the stances of America are indications of negative positions towards society and its citizens. Their decisions and credibility are negative. They damage this country. They said that they are here to spread freedom and democracy in Iraqi society, but they did nothing but bring terrorism.
In other Iraq news, a new video showing former Iraqi President Saddam Hussein after his execution has appeared on the internet. For a television audience, the footage is too graphic to air, but we'll link to it on our website at democracynow.org. Saddam Hussein's body can be seen lying on a hospital trolley, his throat red from a gaping neck wound and a head twisted sharply to one side. The video appeared to have been taken with a mobile phone, as happened with the earlier video that showed the entire hanging. On Tuesday, British Prime Minister Tony Blair broke his silence on Saddam Hussein's execution, calling it unacceptable.
The manner of the execution of Saddam was completely wrong. But that should not blind us to the crimes he committed against his own people, including the death of hundreds of thousands of innocent Iraqis, 1 million casualties in the Iran-Iraq war, and the use of chemical weapons against his own people, wiping out entire villages of people.
Meanwhile, the Iraqi High Tribunal has dropped all charges against Saddam Hussein as the genocide trial of six co-defendants resumed. They're charged with crimes against humanity over a campaign against Kurds in the 1980s that tens of thousands of people died. Hussein was hanged after an earlier trial over the killing of 148 Shia Muslims in the town of Dujail. Critics have voiced disappointment Hussein was not tried for his largest atrocities. In Somalia, U.S. officials have acknowledged the number and identities of victims from Sunday's U.S. airstrike remain unknown. Somali officials say Islamist fighters were killed fleeing along Somali's border with Kenya. Local residents say dozens of civilians were killed. The Pentagon says the target of the strikes were members of al-Qaeda connected to the 98 bombings of the U.S. embassies in Nairobi and Dar es Salaam. On Tuesday, Somali President Abdullah Yusuf Ahmed defended the attack.
I think they are right to strike because some of those who fled are the ones who bombed the embassy in Nairobi and also in Tanzania and a hotel in Mombasa. They are wanted and they are known as terrorists. They destroyed embassies and killed people.
The U.S. airstrike has set off fierce protest in the Somali capital, Mogadishu. This is resident Abdullahi Mohamed Mohamed.
I am very, very sorry about these American airstrikes, but we will take revenge. All our people must talk to each other and not to foreigners. We do not accept these airstrikes on our land by the Americans and the Ethiopians.
In Cuba, a former detainee at the U.S. military prison at Guantanamo Bay joined a human rights delegation Tuesday to call for the prison's closure. Asif Iqbal spoke at a news conference in Havana.
Basically, I've come here to ask for the closure of Guantanamo Bay because we believe in everyone is innocent in Guantanamo Bay until they're proven guilty, but everyone in Guantanamo is basically been labeled as a terrorist and guilty, and that's not the way that democratic countries work.
The delegation also includes peace activists Cindy Sheehan, Medea Benjamin, and Zora Zawawi. Zawawi's son, Omar Degaez, has been jailed at Guantanamo since 2002. The delegation has planned to march to the prison Thursday, the fifth anniversary of the opening of Guantanamo. Thursday's march comes amidst news the number of Guantanamo prisoners hunger striking this month has doubled to at least 11. Back in the United States, the Pentagon's agreed to stop sharing information from its recruiting database with law enforcement and intelligence agencies. The agreement came as part of a settlement in a case brought by six New York high school students who say the Pentagon has improperly passed on personal information gathered from recruiting activities. The Pentagon database is considered the largest repository of information for young people between the ages of 16 and 25. In addition to halting its sharing with other agencies, the Pentagon agreed to destroy personal information after 3 years rather than the previous policy of 5 years or more. The Pentagon also agreed to give students an easier way to opt out of having their personal information on record. In a statement, the New York Civil Liberties Union welcomed the new changes but criticized the Pentagon for refusing to stop collecting information about students' ethnicity in an effort to specifically target people of color. In environmental news, climate officials announced Tuesday that 2006 was the warmest year ever recorded in the United States. And what appears to be a first, the National Climatic Data Center attributed the warmth in part to global warming caused by greenhouse gases. 15 of the years since 1981 rank among the 25 warmest years since record-keeping began. Public housing officials nationwide will be walking off the job today to protest federal budget cuts of subsidized housing. The U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development announced last month plans to reduce funding by nearly 25%. Housing officials are billing the day's action as a national day of silence. They say they'll be forced to lay off housing employees and cut services. In Texas, faculty at Southern Methodist University held a meeting Tuesday to voice concerns over the expected establishment of President Bush's presidential library. SMU has emerged as a likely choice by the president's selection committee. Faculty members complained of a lack of transparency and that administrators have overlooked their concerns. And finally, the lady is a stamp. Yes, the U.S. Postal Service unveils a new stamp today honoring the legendary jazz singer Ella Fitzgerald. Fitzgerald is known as the First Lady of Song. She'll be featured on a 39-cent stamp on sale across the country today. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A high-profile case here in New York is raising questions around police tactics and sting operations in pursuing terror cases. On Monday, a 24-year-old Pakistani immigrant was sentenced to 30 years in prison for plotting to bomb the Herald Square subway station in Manhattan. Shahawar Mateen Siraj was arrested days before the Republican National Convention in 2004 and held without bail. This past May, he was convicted on four counts of conspiracy, including the most serious, plotting to bomb a public transportation system. Attorneys for Siraj say he was entrapped by a paid police informant who cajoled and inflamed him to lure him into the conspiracy, and that it was the informant one who pushed the bombing. Sarraj had no explosives, no timetable for an attack, little understanding about explosives. They also criticized the NYPD's tactics of sending informers and the undercover detectives into mosques to cast a wide net in search of radical Islamists. The police department hailed the 30-year sentence, which is the maximum allowed under federal sentencing guidelines. Commissioner Raymond Kelly said the decision, quote, says that those who conspire against New York will pay a severe price. Martin Stoller now joins me in the studio. He's the lead defense attorney for Mateen Sarraj. We invited the NYPD on the program, but they declined our request. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning, Amy.
Well, tell us the story. What happened?
The story is a fairly simple one. And unfortunately, it's a story that has been replicated across the country. We have a paid police confidential informant who is put into the mosque. It was his job. He was to go to the mosque, one on Staten Island, one in Bay Ridge. And on his way to the mosque, he stopped in a bookstore that was next to the mosque, which is where Mateen, which is what he's known by, worked for his uncle in a bookstore called Islamic Books and Tapes. And he started befriending Mateen. He was twice his age. Mateen was somebody who came from an Ismaili sect of Islam, a rather secular sect, which is viewed in Pakistan as basically not being Islamic. That led to the family leaving because the father and his stores were burned and he was beaten, so the family left. They came to the U.S., and then Mateen runs into this fellow, El Dawoodi, who says, I'm an Islamic scholar, I'm twice your age, let me teach you about what the duty of somebody who's really an Islamic person is. And he begins to befriend him, and as the war in Iraq starts to ramp up, and as the pictures of Abu Ghraib come out, this guy starts to twist this young man. He's 22 years old, he's been in the U.S. since 1999, and he convinces him that it is the duty of somebody who is a true believer to engage in violent jihad, that is to cause great economic harm to the United States. And he twists him and convinces him that it's his duty to do this. As a result, the young man says, let's blow up this 34th Street subway station. And the confidential informant who's pretending to be somebody who's connected with the brothers, the brotherhood, induces the young man to agree to this kind of a plot. And so they discuss it. At some point, he starts taping him, but totally after he has twisted his mind and convinced him that it is his duty as a true believer to carry out some kind of violent jihad. So the plot to blow up the 34th Street subway station develops as a result of the confidential informant who has been in the community and at the mosque for about 2.5 years, doing nothing except reporting on what people say, reporting on what sermons are being delivered at the mosque, and basically coming up with nothing until he develops this young man as somebody who's willing to engage in violent conduct. The plot then, as it's recorded over by an electronic device, is such that the confidential informant is the one who's supposed to supply the explosives. The confidential informant is the one who supplies the backpacks that the explosives are supposed to be kept into. And at the last minute, the young man says, wait a minute, I don't really want to do this. I don't want anybody to get killed. I don't want to be the one that's involved in placing a bomb anyplace. I think I better check with my mother before I go in any further with this plot. 5 days later, he's arrested. And something that began with the New York City Police Department putting a confidential informant into the community and putting him directly at the mosque turns out to be a federal prosecution. And they took it federal because they could get a much longer sentence. So now this young man becomes the symbol of terrorism in the United States. In essence, what we have is the New York City Police Department creating a crime so they could solve the crime and claim a victory in the war on terror.
That is not the way to investigate terrorism, as far as I'm concerned.
Is he recorded on tape saying, I don't want to do this, I'm going to talk to
my dad? Oh, yes, he's recorded on videotape saying, I'd better not do this. I have to check with my parents to see if I really want to go forward with this.
This police informant went to more than 570 times went to the mosque in Staten Island, as well as Bay Ridge, prayer services
that's
there.
That's right. He went to prayer services. Filing reports daily, four or five times a day when he
hundreds
spoke prayers,
of them.
Five times a day. And when he was at the mosque, he would stop next door at the bookstore, talk to Mateen, and then developed enough of a friendship with him, or at least a purported friendship, that he kept driving him home between the Bay Ridge mosque and the bookstore in Brooklyn and his home in Queens, so that they've had a lot of time to have discussions.
Showing him photos of Abu Ghraib.
Showing him photos of Abu Ghraib, discussing with him what his duty was as a true believer, and convincing him that some sort of violent conduct to rock the American economy would result in the troops being brought home from Iraq.
Did he give him explosives?
No explosives were ever given to anybody. The plot had no chance of succeeding because the plan was that the explosives would be provided by the confidential informant. And don't think for a minute that the police, through their confidential informant, would have given him explosives. What they gave him were backpacks so that he could show to Mateen and another young, confused man named James El-Shafei, here's what we're going to do. Here's how we're going to carry out the plot.
And what happened to El-Shafei?
El-Shafei ultimately was also arrested, but agreed to cooperate with the prosecution and testified as a witness at Mateen's trial. Mateen put on an entrapment defense, and it was a legitimate entrapment defense. It was, unfortunately, rejected by the jury. And that has a lot to do with the political climate. If you're a Muslim accused of terrorism, then a jury is very, very hard-bound not to convict you.
Were you surprised by the sentence?
I was surprised by the sentence. It's extraordinarily harsh. In fact, I would say draconian. This is a young man who is not terribly bright, who was easily manipulated into being somebody who agreed to go along with somebody who he thought was an Islamic scholar. And you just don't sentence somebody who is got no prior record, is not terribly bright, is easily manipulated, has done nothing except work since he came to the United States. And the penological purpose of sentencing somebody to 30 years is what? To, essentially what we've had is we've had a symbol of terrorism sentenced. A 30-year sentence is ridiculous, especially when you compare it to a sentence that was handed down the same day in Germany to somebody who was a Confederate of the 9/11 bombers, who was sentenced basically for his role in mass murder, sentenced to 15 years in jail. And here is this young man in the U.S. who was manipulated and set up to be involved in a bombing conspiracy that never had a chance to go anyplace, to 30 years. What kind of message does that send?
So the sentence comes down Monday. Tuesday, Siraj's mother, father, and 19-year-old sister are detained yesterday?
Yes, unfortunately. I mean, what a remarkable coincidence that the day after their son is sentenced to 30 years, the parents and the sister are picked up by the immigration authorities.
Now, they have been applying for asylum here?
The father and the mother and the sister all have an appeal pending on a claim of political asylum.
From
Pakistan. You remember I told you they were Ismaili, and a sect of Islam which is viewed politically as not really being Islamic in the neighborhood of Pakistan where they grew up. So that was the political asylum claim. It was rejected by immigration initially at their hearing, and now it's been on appeal to the Second Circuit Court of Appeals down here in Manhattan, and nothing changed. They've been out, they've been free, they've not run away, they haven't done anything.
Have they been at the trial? Had they been?
Yes, they were at the trial. His father was at the trial almost every day. The sister came every once in a while, and his mother came and testified as a witness at the trial about her son's basic good disposition, that he was not somebody who was an evil person. What the government has done by painting this young man, who is really not very bright, as the mastermind behind the plot to bomb the 34th Street subway, is really creating a devil so that they can lock up the devil. It's just not the way to fight the war on terror, to the extent that there is a war.
And this wide net that has been cast, the practice of sending in undercover officers into mosques.
Well, not only did they have this confidential informant in the mosque, but at the same time, there was an undercover police officer whose name we only know as Kamil Pasha, who, about 2 years before these events took place, was placed directly into that community. He was taken out of the police academy after 3 or 4 weeks in the police academy, told, you go undercover into the Bay Ridge community, and we'll make you a Gold Shield detective if you do it for a couple of years for us. And sure enough, he went out totally without any kind of brief, without any kind of training, to go into the community and listen for what he could hear. So he testified ultimately at the trial that when he heard Mateen talk about the fact that Mateen thought that he could understand why Palestinians might use suicide bombing because they had no other means of making their point as a political statement, he thought this was the most radical thing he'd ever heard. He'd never heard of Palestinian suicide bombing before he met Mateen, who said something about it. Now, these are common political discussions that go on in the community, and this guy was reporting back political statements that people were making. Statements by Mateen, for example, that said, look, if the U.S. invades Iraq, I bet there's going to be another act of terrorism. That's not something that says, I want to engage in terrorism. That's making a political statement that says, this is going to happen.
Martin Stoller, I want to thank you very much for being with us. We will continue to follow this case and the case of Siraj's mother, father, and sister. Thank you.
Thank you.
Martin Stoller, attorney for Shahawar Mateen Siraj, sentenced this week to 30 years in prison. His family has now been detained. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Back in a minute.
You're done with me.
Teacher, teacher, did you not behave? Did you teach the children war is not okay? Why are you packing up your stuff? Did they ship you out to shut you up? What's happening here? Soldier, soldier, did you lose a limb? Based on a rich man's will, where are all your benefits? Did they fund the tax cuts for the rich? What's happening here? But you know you gotta rise up, see the truth, shout out.
What's happening here? Jamie Green here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The watchdog group Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington has called for a congressional investigation into whether radio and TV Marti can be broadcast over the commercial airwaves in southern Florida. The Martis are run by the U.S. government and have historically been beamed into Cuba as part of an effort to overthrow the Castro government.
Radio Martí, les habla Eduardo Luján y me acompañan en el estudio.
Juana Isa Noticias, Radio Martí.
En Miami, José Luis Ramos, Noticias, Radio Martí.
The Bush administration recently reached deals with two South Florida commercial Spanish-language TV and radio stations to broadcast the Martiz. The government's paying the stations almost $200,000 to air a daily hour of Radio Martí programming for 6 months. This is despite a U.S. law prohibiting broadcasting of propaganda inside the United States. Radio and TV Martí have also come under fire for mismanagement and corruption. In November, a senior TV Martí official was indicted by federal prosecutors in a kickback for contract scheme. The Inspector General's office has already launched a review into the operations of the Office of Cuba Broadcasting, which oversees Radio and TV Martí. And Massachusetts Congressmember William Delahunt, who's slated to head the Oversight and Investigation Subcommittee for the House International Relations Committee, has promised to hold hearings on the Martiz later this month. Well, today we're going to debate the issue. Joe Garcia is with us, director of the Hispanic Strategy Center at the New Democratic Network. He's also a former executive director of the Cuban American National Foundation, known as CAMF. He joins us in Washington, D.C. On the phone with us is Professor John Nichols. He's a professor of communications at Penn State University, focuses on international communications. He is co-author of the book Clandestine Radio Broadcasting. Joe O'Connell is the director of public affairs for International Broadcasting Bureau, which is the U.S. government organization that oversees Radio and TV Martí, as well as Voice of America. We welcome you all to Democracy Now! Let us begin with Joe O'Connell, Director of Public Affairs for International Broadcasting Bureau. Can you tell us what the plan is for Radio and TV Martí in Southern Florida?
Well, starting last month, I think around December 18th, TV and Radio Martí, as you just said, began broadcasting 1 hour a day, respectively, on two South Florida stations, WAQI AM, which is also known as Radio Mambí, and which is the only 50,000-watt overnight Spanish station, Spanish-language station in South Florida. And then for TV, WPMF, which is a Channel 38 TV Azteca station, and which also broadcasts into DirecTV via that same channel. So that gives us 1 hour Monday through Friday on radio, and 1 hour Monday through Friday on Channel 38, and also simultaneously on DirecTV into Cuba.
And the issue of the Smith-Mundt Act, the act that says that U.S. propaganda that is made for overseas audiences, whether it's Radio Free Europe, Voice of America, or Radio or TV Martí, cannot be broadcast in the United States?
Right. Actually, the law or the clause of the law you're citing is from 1948, the so-called Smith-Mundt Act. It doesn't use the word propaganda. It simply says material. And the reason why that clause was added back in 1948 was because the representatives of the U.S. of American media of the time, which was mostly newspapers and wire services and radio, came forward and said that they didn't want to compete with a government news organization. And so that has stayed on the books through all of the technology which we now know about, most recently, of course, the Internet. And so these, VOA itself has long had a website. TV and Radio Martí have websites, notwithstanding the fact that the clause says that you can't broadcast into the United States. It's the same. The logic is the same with shortwave, which is what VOA's original broadcast medium was. The shortwave was available in this country to anybody that had a shortwave radio. Satellite TV is available to anybody who has a satellite dish, and the Internet is available to anybody that has a computer. But the intended audience for these broadcasts is overseas, in this case, Cuba.
John Nichols, Penn State University professor, your response?
Well, it's throwing good money after bad. These stations have been on the air for a very long time, and they are a colossal waste of the taxpayers' money. This new gimmick, like all the previous gimmicks, is not going to change the basic equation that the stations are, for the most part, not heard or seen on the island, are ineffective in achieving U.S. foreign policy goals. Indeed, they're counterproductive. And on top of that, just for the sugarcoating, is they violate our treaty obligations under international law.
What are those treaty obligations? What are those treaty obligations?
Pardon?
What are those treaty obligations?
Well, they're very complex and probably don't want to go into great detail on them, but essentially what they say is that nations have the sovereign right to govern their own domestic broadcasting systems. And in the same way that the United States would be displeased and go to the international bodies if Canada or Mexico presumed to dictate what's on the air in our own country, Cuba has the same rights.
Joe Garcia is in the studio in Washington, D.C., with the New Democratic Network, formerly executive director of Cuban American National Foundation. Many people might be surprised to hear that you are opposed to radio and TV, Martí. CAMF is known for its fierce anti-Castro activism.
Well, let's take a step back. I'm not opposed to radio and TV, Martí. The organization I still sit on the board of was very supportive of the legislation that created both. What I am opposed to is the, first of all, Mr. O'Connell's characterization. These are stations that produce information for Cuba, and yet they are being used to broadcast in South Florida. What Mr. O'Connell doesn't tell you is that on the same wavelength that Radio Mambí transmits 50,000 watts, Cuba has Radio Rebelde, a 100-watt radio station, which is the most powerful in Latin America. If the antenna of the station that they are transmitting on were located in downtown Havana, you still wouldn't be able to hear it. So I agree that this is good. This is throwing good money at something that is going to have no effect whatsoever. So it's wasting money. And where I think radio and TV Martí have failed is that they have become nothing more than a political patronage setup in South Florida for the Republican Party, as opposed to the very important things that were created by Radio Free Europe and Voice of America, which were an objective information in societies that were closed. And unquestionably, that is not what Radio Martí is achieving today. In fact, it is descending into ridiculous bickering like this, where it is transmitting to local Cuban Americans as opposed to meeting its mission and its objective, which is to put information inside of Cuba. And I want to stress two things. The issue about TV Martí transmitting over DirecTV, they could have bought time in a TV station in Utah and done the same thing. They pick South Florida because they want to transmit also to the Cuban American community the production and the material that they're doing, which isn't the purpose of this, and they are flouting the law. And secondly, the very fact that they could have picked a whole myriad of stations that are located in South Florida to transmit directly to Cuba, and they didn't do that. What they did is they picked one station which will not get into Cuba and will simply have effect locally in terms of the Cuban American population.
Well, Joe, you probably also know that there's nothing new here. Ever since Radio Martí went on the air in 1985, it has broadcast in both shortwave and medium wave, or AM, the AM transmitter being in Marathon Key.
Right.
And that's always been audible in South Florida.
Absolutely, and I've listened
just
to
as
it.
The TV has been ever since it went on the air in 1990 to people who have dishes. So there's nothing really new here as on the angle of that this is somehow aimed at Cubans in South Florida. You know, I guess you could make the argument it's been aimed at them all along, because this is not
aimed. The difference here is maybe 1 out of 10 Americans have shortwave radio and could find it.
But I'm talking about medium. I'm talking about AM out of Marathon Key. I'm not talking about shortwave.
And in Dade County, that AM station is inaudible, as most Cuban stations on the island are very difficult to pick up. I tell you, as someone who lives in South Florida who monitors TV Martí, but I have to use the internet to do it, which is not a particularly easy thing. And secondly, you know, Joe, what's sad is that the mission of Radio and TV Martí, which I believe you believe in, and I disagree with the professor, are important and should be followed. We are engaging in an absurd spectacle of spending $400,000 to spend an hour of programming on both medium, which will have absolutely no effect and simply puts TV Martí's administration and purposes into more doubt and creates more argument that will lead to not more funding, but less funding, not more effectiveness, but less effectiveness, and in the end, will have achieved none of the purposes that were there. Of course, Of course that I could have picked up Radio and TV Marti through the internet or through shortwave radio. But the truth is, most Cubans already have those mediums, and in Cuban Americans in Miami would need a special effort to get it in. So I think that we've done nothing but create more controversy in what is already a controversial program, which I believe you and I favor its mission. Unfortunately, by doing this type of activity, all we've done is put it in further peril.
We're talking to Joe Garcia, director of the Hispanic Strategy Center at the New Democratic Network. We're also talking with Joe O'Connell, director of public affairs at International Broadcasting Bureau. And we're joined by John Nichols, professor of communications at Penn State University, who has written about clandestine radio broadcasting. Where does Radio and TV Marti fit into that? John Nichols.
What was the question?
How does Radio and TV Marti fit into clandestine radio broadcasting?
It's not. It's overt broadcasting. It's not clandestine. There have been, of course, scores of clandestine stations operated by various exiled groups and also by the Central Intelligence Agency that have broadcast into Cuba under the similar purpose of trying to overthrow the Castro government, but none of them are currently on the air. They've been off the air for some time.
John Nichols, can you talk about the history of Radio and TV Marti and Central Intelligence Agency and overall broadcasting in Cuba, the strategy of trying to overthrow Castro through broadcasting here?
Well, the broadcast wars over the Straits of Florida are probably the most intense of any political broadcasting activity at any time in history, any place in the world. And it's probably a reflection of the longstanding conflict and hostility between the two countries. I agree with Mr. Garcia. I mean, in the past, we've disagreed on a variety of different issues, but I agree with most of the substance of what he said, and one of them is that if the purpose of these stations is to resolve problems, to improve the lot for the Cuban people, and to resolve the considerable differences between Cuba and the United States, these stations clearly are not doing it. Indeed, there's strong indication that they're pushing it in the opposite direction. I also agree with Mr. O'Connell to some extent that this new flap is not a substantial change from the past. But what it does, it just moves it along the continuum further and makes it more transparent of how bankrupt politically these stations are, and how much of a waste of the taxpayers' money that they are.
Professor Nichols, if I could just interject.
This is Joe O'Connell.
As you know, the Soviets jammed the Voice of America and the BBC and other Western broadcasters for 50-plus years. I don't recall anybody suggesting that VOA stopped broadcasting or the BBC stopped broadcasting into Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union because it was being jammed. I mean, those broadcasts continued, and they both for reasons of getting through, which they did, and also because of their symbolic value, that people there, as we now know, knew that there was somebody outside who cared and was there. And so that's one point. The other point is I don't think we can ignore in this discussion the cost, the serious cost for the Cuban government of this continuous jamming. I mean, one engineering estimate I've seen is that it cost the government, and that's from an energy-starved island, as we all know, that they use something like 8.5 million watts an hour to jam both radio and TV. I mean, I'm told that's enough to power a small industrialized city. If these broadcasts are useless and no good and irrelevant, then why would they do that? I mean, I think that's a question. That's not the only answer, but that's a question.
Let me break in, though, to what Joe's saying here, because I think it's tremendously
Joe
important.
Joe Garcia.
Yeah. First off, let's go back to the transmissions of Radio and TV Marti are tremendously important, and I believe they should continue. I believe the programming should get better. And I also want to agree with something that Joe said. One of the hallmarks of Radio Free Europe transmission was when the Iron Curtain came down, they asked Vaclav Havel how important the transmissions of Radio Free Europe was. And he said, you might as well ask me how important air and water is to sustain human life. They were essential. They were a signal of freedom. I'm not against the transmissions of radio and TV Marti. What I am against is these illegal payoffs to local providers of content in South Florida, which are not going to reach Cuba, but are only reaching the Cuban-American community. The station they have opted to pay $200,000 to cannot be heard in Cuba, and it is the most right-wing Republican station on the dial. These guys do nothing more than parrot the position of the administration. And that's why I think the choice Mr. O'Connell made is pathetic and absurd. And I'm not accusing him of doing it, but the administration of Radio and TV Marti, because in the end, what it is a political payoff, and what it is putting out Radio and TV Marti propaganda in the community to engage in a political debate that is not the purpose of Radio and TV Marti. There are an infinite number of Cuban-American radio stations and Cuban radio stations in the dial in South Florida, from the left to the right, who engage in this debate all the time. What Radio and TV Marti's purpose is not to engage in the debate, but to provide a window of freedom and opportunity to the people of Cuba, not to South Florida exiles. And that is where I think Mr. O'Connell has gone wrong. That is where the CREW motion, Citizens for Responsible and Ethical in Washington, and Melanie Sloan, are absolutely correct. What we've done is stepped into a violation of the law, which I think will have no benefit to Radio and TV Marti. Will bring, again, more questions about what it does and how it operates. And in the end, I think will hurt both stations.
Well, I should.
John Nichols, your response.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Mr. O'Connell raised 3 points. I'd like to quickly go through them.
That was Joe Garcia.
John Nichols, yes. This is the issue of the cost of jamming on the part of the Cuban government. I am highly skeptical of those figures. I mean, indeed, if it were true, the U.S. government has figured out a way not only to violate international law but also to violate the laws of physics. And the cost to jam a station, particularly a TV station, is only an infinitesimal fraction of what it costs to broadcast. But we've been trying very hard to get those very engineering studies and have them publicly disclosed so we could see. So I challenge Mr. O'Connell to release that engineering data and so there can be a meaningful discussion about it. The second point he raised about the symbolism, even if the stations are not heard in Cuba, the symbolism of broadcasting to Cuba and comparing it to a Voice of America during the Cold War. I mean, how about the symbolism of the United States being in knowing and willful violation of our international treaty obligations, the largest and most powerful country of the world, broadcasting to a small country in violation of international law? That is not good symbolism for our international reputation in difficult times.
But interestingly enough, that's the same kind of thing that, you know, we used to hear from the Soviets and even today from China about interference in their internal affairs by broadcasting to those countries. I mean, we look at the UN Declaration of Human Rights, which says that everybody has the right to receive and impart information across or regardless of frontiers. So if you're suggesting that somehow international broadcasting across borders is illegal, then I think that flies in the face of the history of international broadcasting throughout the Cold War and the recognition that it's been given that it was
That's
helpful.
Joe O'Connell, who's oversees Radio and TV Marti. Professor Nichols, your response.
It's an interesting legal discussion that we debate over and over again, but no matter, the relevant international body, the International Telecommunications Union, has repeatedly, this is the international judicial body that governs international broadcasting and makes the decisions in these kinds of disputes. And it is ruled repeatedly that the United States is out of compliance with its treaty obligations by broadcasting TV Marti, and repeatedly tells the United States to cease and desist, and the United States repeatedly says, buzz off. So It's not the judge and jury have decided. We could debate about whether the judge and jury are right, but the decision has already been made.
You know, I want to ask a quick question of Professor Nichols. Joe O'Connell talked about the Smith-Mundt Act as being put in place just so that commercial broadcasters wouldn't have to compete with government broadcasting. But wasn't Smith-Mundt actually put in place because the U.S. saw the power of state propaganda because of the Nazis and to guard against that kind of propagandizing of a home population?
Yes, I believe that's true. I mean, Mr. O'Connell is partially right in saying that domestic media did not want to have competition. But you're correct as well. There was a considerable part of the debate said that the United States, the Congress did not want a taxpayer-funded a propaganda arsenal turned against our own people, inherently undemocratic.
While those goals may have been noble, if you look at the legislative history
in the 1940s, certainly, they've been overtaken by the technology that Mr. O'Connell went through, and so I'm not too sure those laws, although they're still in the books, are the major issue here.
Joe O'Connell, what does it mean for you that Congressmember Delahunt says he's going to conduct hearings into Radio and TV Marti? How are you preparing for this?
Well, we've already said that we welcome the congressman's, announcement about conducting hearings anyway, if not an investigation. I mean, we're happy and prepared to work with him and his staff. Speaking of laws, I wanted to get in that both of the pieces of legislation, the Radio Marti, the Broadcasting to Cuba Act, which is the original enabling legislation back in the 80s, which created Radio Marti, and then more recently, the TV Marti Act, which created it in 1990, both contain language, one more clear than the other, but nonetheless language which say that or which authorize the U.S. government to lease time on, quote, other commercial or non-commercial education AM band radio broadcasting stations if broadcast to Cuba on 1180 AM or subject to jamming or interference. The jamming, of course, is well established. Similarly, TV Marti, and this is referring to the section of the Smith-Mundt Act that we were just talking about, the so-called prohibition on domestic dissemination. It says that that the Broadcasting Board of Governors, which is a parent agency of all U.S. government-supported overseas broadcasters, shall, notwithstanding the section of the Smith-Mundt Act, shall provide for open communication of information and ideas through the use of television broadcasting to Cuba. So we believe that we have the authority under these pieces of legislation to do this. And the other thing I wanted to add is that the steps that were taken a month ago or several weeks ago in mid-December by way of putting the TV and Radio Marti broadcasts on the local stations via the local stations in South Florida, these are just additional steps, as both Joe and Professor Nichols know. The airborne TV Marti broadcast started back in August. The use of satellite has been in place for some time. I mean, these are various ways in which they're trying to get these broadcasts into Cuba, as has been recommended twice by the committee. The Committee for Assistance to a Free Cuba noted in both its 2004 and its 2006 reports.
Professor Nichols, your response, and we're going to have to wrap it here.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear the question.
Your response to what Mr. O'Connell is saying, and we're going to have to wrap up here.
I think he's correct that the language that might permit this kind of domestic blowback is there, certainly in the case of Radio Marti, but it's highly questionable in the case of TV Marti. But again, it skirts the issue of even if they get the signal into Cuba, even if Cuba chooses not to jam, will the Cuban people embrace the voice of what Mr. Garcia appropriately described as a station loaded with right wing silliness, and I think it's highly doubtful. The Cuban people are not idiots. They know the difference between good, solid, objective information that they used to get over Voice of America, and the shrill political stuff that they get in radio and TV, Marti.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. John Nichols, professor of communications at Penn State University, thank you for being with us. Joe O'Connell, director of public affairs for the International Broadcasting Bureau, which oversees radio and TV, Marti. And finally, Joe Garcia of the New Democratic Network, former executive director of the Cuban American National Foundation in Washington, D.C.
Thank you.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We'll be back in a minute.
Shining bright above you, night breezes seem to whisper, I love you. Birds singing in the sycamore tree, dream a little dream of me. Say nighty night and kiss me. Just hold me tight and tell me you'll miss me while I'm alone and blue as can be. Dream a little dream of me. Stars fading, but I linger on, dear. Still craving your kiss. I'm longing to linger till dawn, dear. Just saying this. Sweet dreams till sunbeams find you. Sweet dreams that leave all worries behind you. But in your dreams, whatever they be, dream a little dream of me.
Dream a little dream of me, Ella Fitzgerald. She's having a stamp that is being released today, a 39-cent stamp in her honor. This is Democracy Now! We're broadcasting on over 500 stations around the country, on Pacifica and NPR stations, low-power FM, college and community radio stations, on Dish Network and DirecTV, Dish Network 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV, Channel 375, which, yes, does broadcast in Cuba. We are also on public access TV and PBS stations, and we are video and audio podcasting. Our headlines are in Spanish, and 100 radio stations around the world are taking those headlines in Spanish. We are also heading to Memphis. Tomorrow we'll be broadcasting there from the National Conference on Media Reform on Friday, talking about big media. And we'll also be there on Monday on the federal holiday that honors Dr. Martin Luther King. We'll be in Memphis, the place where he was assassinated, April 4th, 1968. So tell your friends to tune in for these two special broadcasts. As we turn now to President Bush, who is set to give a major address today outlining a new U.S. strategy in Iraq. The strategy is expected to include an increase of up to 20,000 troops. Since the new Congress took the Hill on Friday, the possibility of a troop surge has drawn increasing criticism from leading Democrats. Senator Ted Kennedy introduced legislation yesterday which would require the president to gain congressional authority before escalating the war in Iraq. Last week, Kennedy became chair of the Senate Subcommittee on Refugees, Border Security, and Immigration, and has also been a vocal critic of the Bush administration's policies towards Iraqi refugees. In an op-ed published in a recent issue of The Washington Post, Kennedy condemned the administration's handling of the refugee situation. He cited the fact that while the 2007 budget proposal allots $8 billion to spending on the war, it currently has set aside only a tiny fraction of that amount, $21 million, to aid the growing number of Iraqi refugees. Until recently, the Bush administration planned to settle only 500 Iraqi refugees in the United States this year, even as the international situation has grown increasingly dire. The UN estimates that 1 in 8 Iraqis have fled their homes and that 1.7 million Iraqis are now displaced. Tens of thousands of people continue to flee Iraq monthly. Up to 1 million Iraqi refugees are in Syria. Up to 700,000 are in Jordan. Yesterday, the UN issued a plea for $60 million in emergency funds to deal with the Iraqi refugee crisis. Well, in November, a team from the group Refugees International traveled to Syria, Jordan, and Lebanon. They issued a report called Iraq, the world's fastest growing refugee crisis. Sean Garcia is an advocate with Refugees International. He's part of the group that filed the report, joins me now in Washington, D.C. Welcome to Democracy Now.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us what the scope of the Iraqi refugee crisis is.
Sure. As you had mentioned, we have almost 100,000 people leaving Iraq every month, 40,000 of them alone going into Syria. It totals about 1.7. We expect it to reach 2 million people in the upcoming months scattered across the Middle East. And while they are spreading out across the region, they are receiving almost no international support. The UN, which is the lead agency that handles refugees in the region, only had $1 per person per year to deal with Iraqis last year. While they've increased their budget this year, it's only a doubling of what they had last year. So we're still expecting Iraqi refugees to receive very little international support in 2007.
Sean, only 500 Iraqi refugees are allowed in the United States?
That is a planning number from what we've been told by the Department of State. They can let in many more than that under an unspecified cap that can go to any people from any part of the world. The real block right now to resettling Iraqi refugees in the U.S. is actually budgetary. And while we've been speaking with the Department of State about that 500 number, the reality is that they don't have the budget to resettle thousands of people in the U.S. right now. So they are trying to put out there that they want to resettle more, but the reality is they don't have the money to do it.
What about Iraqis who are working with the U.S. government or U.S. military?
That is almost very, very restricted. There are only 50 spots for translators that work for the U.S. military in either Iraq or Afghanistan to come into the U.S. every year. With the tens of thousands of people who are contracting for the United States inside of Iraq, almost all of those people's lives are at risk because they work with coalition forces. And right now they have no option of how to escape Iraq other than to flee to Jordan or Syria, where they have very little support again. 50 of them will come to the U.S., but that's clearly not enough.
What are the implications of this refugee massive exodus out of Iraq for the region?
It definitely could have a very destabilizing effect on the region. What we are seeing is that while people are supporting themselves currently on their life savings, those savings will only last people no more than 4 or 5 months. As soon as those resources run out, if the international community doesn't start helping people with housing, with food, with medicine, with education, we will see very restive populations of Iraqis throughout the region. And for example, in Jordan, where we have up to 700,000 Iraqis, that's almost 10% of the Jordanian population now being native-born in Iraq.
And what are the conditions of the refugee camps in places like Jordan, Syria, Lebanon?
Sure. They're actually not living in camp. These are urban refugees. They come from large cities like Baghdad or Fallujah, and they're moving to urban areas like Amman and Damascus. So they've basically blended into the urban poor, and they are living in the same conditions as many poor in these areas, but they are in very basic rudimentary housing, many without indoor plumbing, many without electricity, very, very basic food supplies. Many people that we've spoke to are not able to put their children in school because they can't afford school supplies. They are most definitely foregoing medical care, which is not provided to them by these host countries, and living, again, in very tenuous conditions. If they don't receive help soon, their resources will run out and they have nowhere to turn.
And what happens to them at the border of places like Jordan, Syria, Lebanon? Are they turned back at any point?
The Syrian border is the only one that's open throughout the region at this point that's allowing a free flow of Iraqis in. Jordan, which is the other main country that borders Iraq that is receiving refugees, has closed that border down significantly in the past year. They don't allow men 18 to 35 in, they don't allow the elderly in, and they don't allow anyone who's carrying enough baggage to make it look like they'll stay. We're told border control agents have discretion to decide who comes in and who doesn't, so there is no set policy, but we are hearing of increasing numbers of Iraqis turned away at the Jordanian border. Syria right now is their only option.
Sean Garcia, thanks so much for joining us. We'll certainly link to your report at our website. Sean Garcia is with Refugees International. That does it for our broadcast, Democracy Now!, produced by Mike Burke, Shufa Dokadoush, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yuba Rich, and Aramate Lee Burek, Jen Yutz, Anna Nagara, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nagara, our engineers. Our website, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.